A rare genetic disorder lurks in Bonnie Ruff's family tree. It's called hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, or HED. When she and her husband started planning a family, she discovered that any child she conceived had a 1 in 4 chance of having to live with HED. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Before conceiving a child, Ruff was faced with a number of very difficult decisions. To make those decisions, she turned to her family history and investigated the life of her grandfather, a brilliant but miserable man who had lived with the disorder. She also had to explore her feelings for her brother, a college freshman who also struggled with the effects of HED. She's written about her odyssey in the new book, Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. And she'll talk with us about what she found out about the disease, her family, and herself after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Any pregnancy carries with it certain risks, but when Bonnie Ruff and her husband started thinking about starting a family, they quickly realized that the risks for their children were higher than most. Any child Bonnie Ruff conceived would have about a 25% chance of being born with a rare genetic disorder. Bonnie's written about the journey that she took on the pathway to parenthood in the new book, Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. And Bonnie, your family has a history of this genetic disorder, which is, and I hope I'm going to say it correctly, hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia.
That was perfect.
And the short terminology, which I will be using a lot, is HED. Can you tell me a little bit about the disease and what it, or the disorder and what it does?
Sure. The primary symptoms of HED are sparse hair, few teeth, no sweat glands, and an unusual facial bone structure. So even from the sound of those symptoms, you can hear that it's somewhat of a surface sort of disorder, at least at first glance. That was something that I had to grapple with. Is it more than skin deep, this disorder? Is it something that I needed to take more seriously than I ever had before? I learned eventually that aside from the risks of not being able to regulate body temperature and the difficulties of not having teeth, there were also secondary symptoms of the disorder that seemed to be connected with the disorder as it was experienced by the people in my family line. So immunodeficiency problems, and so a susceptibility to infections, especially respiratory infections. So my grandfather, who had the disorder, really was sick for most of his life.
You also write that people who have this disorder are fatigued a lot. They need a lot of sleep.
I think that the problem is that sleeping is difficult when you don't breathe well at night. So I think a real problem for my grandfather was sleep apnea. Because of that facial bone structure I talked about, the specific symptom is a saddle nose deformity, which is a deep depression where the bridge of the nose should be, and that makes breathing difficult. So anybody who's suffered from sleep disorders would know that if your sleep is disturbed a lot at night, you might find yourself exhausted during the day and maybe looking for other ways to bring your energy back.
And also, as part of this disorder, people are born without tear ducts?
Yeah, that's right. I think, unfortunately, I don't know all the intricacies of the science, but I wonder if that has to do with the same mechanism that wouldn't develop sweat glands in the skin.
And, you know, obviously we all take our tear ducts for granted, but I can imagine that that would be very irritating to not have eye moisture and not have nose moisture.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. My brother, who also was born with HED, struggles with things like allergies. I think when my eyes itch, his eyes burn, sort of thing. So, yeah, I think that's another difficulty. And something that for me as a woman looking ahead to potentially starting a family and considering whether this was something to risk passing to my children, I tend to think, too, about the emotional side of things. I wonder what it's like for a child to grow up who can only cry with an expression and a sound, but not in a way that's recognizable to everyone else. I remember when my brother was just a little baby and my wonderful, loving grandmother was taking care of him, all three of us kids, and he was crying and fussing and crying and fussing, and she just kind of was trying to soothe him and said offhand, "Oh, these, you're not even really crying. There aren't even any tears." And I was just 8 years old, but I remember that still, thinking, but he is really crying. And, you know, later realizing that that's something to go through life with, just a sense that even your emotions might not be clear to those around you.
And when you talk about being born without sweat glands, I suppose that's the kind of thing that, that people would make a flip remark about, oh, well, then I wouldn't have to shower nearly as much. But in living with your brother, what are the repercussions of that on a daily basis? What do you have to do to cope?
Well, there are two sides of that coin. My brother is a wonderful soul who's got a terrific sense of humor. And so he makes those flip remarks himself. You know, he, you know, I don't have to change my socks every day. It doesn't matter. My feet don't stink. And along those same lines, when I interviewed a doctor of my grandfather's, the doctor said one of the details he remembered most about my grandfather, who died in 1979, was that he always had really nice leather shoes. It was as if his shoes just never wore out. And my grandfather had explained to him, well, you know, these shoes don't take much of a beating, at least not from the inside. So, but then it's also dangerous and uncomfortable. When my brother was a baby, my parents taught us right away how to help take care of him and keep him comfortable. We grew up in Seattle, where summers aren't nearly as difficult as they would be for someone with a disorder here in the Midwest or in Nebraska, where my grandfather grew up. But we needed to help my brother with things like just making sure that he was in a cool room with a fan if he overheated while he was playing. We would teach him to dunk his T-shirt in water, and then when his T-shirt dried out, we would give him a spray bottle or give him a fresh, wet T-shirt to wear, you know, if he was heading off on a bike ride or a snake hunt, whatever. So it was a matter of really physically keeping his body cool, more from the outside than the inside. It wasn't such a big deal to make sure he had a lot of glasses of water a day, because that wasn't going to come out the way we all hope. So, yeah.
Do you remember a time that he overheated, that he needed extra care because of that?
You know, I have a vague memory of a time when my mother was really terrified. We were riding in the car. This would have been, you know, the late 80s. My mom had this great V-dub bug, and that's the way we rolled. My brother was very, very quiet. He was just a baby and sleeping in the front seat. And I think he had a really red cheeks, and she was hurrying home because she thought that something was going quite wrong. It is a disorder that, before it was well understood, did take babies' lives. But once we finally knew what it was a matter of just make sure that we could get that baby cool. But sometimes those body temperatures just get too higher than we can control. So I wish I could remember the rest of the story exactly right, but I think my mom, I think it ultimately was just something like my brother was just really sleepy or had one too many blankets on, and it was whatever it was a quick fix. But I remember her panicking, because there's just this, you know, what mom needs one more way to worry about her baby dying? It's scary.
In your family history, before this disorder was really understood, it seemed to just show up
right
every once in a while. What do we know about how this disorder is carried and how it's passed along?
HED, like many genetic disorders, is an X-linked disorder. So that means that it's carried by females invisibly. So I, as a carrier, don't have symptoms of the disorder, but I could pass that gene mutation to sons or daughters. Half of my daughters, statistically speaking, would be carriers of the disorder like myself, but would not have health problems. And half of my sons would be perfectly healthy, and the other half would be affected with the disorder. So that's that 1 in 4 chance of having a baby born with disorder. That baby would, generally speaking, almost always be a boy.
And as a carrier, in your book, you did write about some symptoms of the disorder that you do have.
There are signs on carriers' bodies sometimes. Before genetic testing, which is such a brand new frontier in medicine, which is also the thing that made this book a story, that Dan and I had options. We didn't have to have this disorder for our children, but we had these difficult choices to make around, you know, whether and how to avoid the disorder. Medical genetics, of course, makes knowing ahead of time that I'm a carrier possible and knowing ahead of time whether a baby would be born with a disorder. But before medical genetics and scientists had found the gene mutation, which only happened when I was in college in the late 90s, doctors just had to look for clues, and they still will. I had a doctor examine me when I was a young child. She looked at my hair growth, the patterns of my pores, to see if there were kind of hairless or poreless patches on my skin, which there are. I hadn't really noticed, but also unusual dentition or... yeah, those are kind of the main things.
You actually had fewer teeth then?
No, your mother had fewer teeth. Yeah, exactly. Right? She had more signs of it than I did. So doctors sort of said, you know, Bonnie, your anomalies are ones that any woman could have, but you should be tested just in case, knowing your family history.
When your mother discovered or heard the news that now this genetic disorder could be tested for, what was her reaction like?
She called me so excited in my college dorm room. I remember still getting that call. She said, they found the gene. They found the gene. And for me, you know, I was still young. I wasn't really thinking about my family and my future in that way. And so I didn't really feel as much of a thrill as she did. I just thought, well, you know, great. So far, so good. Everything in my life seems to work out fairly well. And here's another one. It sounds like it'll be solved by the time I need to have children. But what I didn't really understand at the time was that, and I don't know if my mom really saw the whole picture either, that now that a woman could know whether she was a carrier and could know ahead of time whether she risked passing the disorder to her children, she had a new responsibility that none of my foremothers had the responsibilities that I would eventually have. You, even if you choose not to test, not to be tested, not to test a pregnancy, that's still a choice. That's still deliberate. And that is what I think is so fascinating and so challenging for the current childbearing generation, when technology is moving so fast and we don't have much human history to draw on as we try to reshape our ethics as we have these choices in front of us.
Well, we'll talk more about the choices that you did have to make and the path that you took to making those choices in a moment. My guest is Bonnie Ruff. She's the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. And you can join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPRTalk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Bonnie Ruff. She is the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA, a book that she wrote about her pathway to parenthood. She is the carrier for a rare genetic disorder called HED and discovered shortly after contemplating becoming a mother that she was a carrier for that, and one in four of her children, or her child, had a one in four chance of having the disorder. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I want to return again to that moment when your mother discovered that this gene could be tested for. You write that even if your mother had this information, she was a devout Catholic and didn't practice birth control, she didn't have the choices or possibly wouldn't have made the choices or even considered the choices that you were faced with at that point. Did you talk to her once you decided to become a mother? Did you talk to her about all of the many choices that you faced?
That's a great question. No one's ever asked me that before, and I'm spinning back through my memory to try to remember, but I don't think I did try to sort out my choices with my mom. It took me a long time to realize exactly what my choices were, and by the time Dan and I were looking at the possibilities for whether and how to prevent the disorder for our children, I felt like we were deep into our own journey, and there were a lot of considerations for, I think, just the sort of the comfort and dignity of my other family members to keep that private until we knew what we were doing. When my mom called me when I was in college with the news that they'd found the gene, I think at the time I thought that meant that, oh, you know, they can just grab a few of my eggs that don't have it and we'll make some babies some easy way. I mean, to me, it was all so far away that it was hard to imagine how wrenching it can be to have so much technology and medicine involved in what for most people is a perfectly natural and fairly easy thing to accomplish, pregnancy. So,
when you started actually thinking about becoming pregnant, what did you perceive your choices to be?
Well, when we first started thinking about it, we had to decide whether HED was serious enough to really try to avoid. So from the very beginning, our choices were do nothing, see what fate hands to us, and be great parents no matter what, which I'm sure we could be. Or maybe we would decide that we don't want the disorder for our children, in which case we could say, well, we may adopt. We may try IVF, in vitro fertilization with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is when once embryos are made, then they're tested, the DNA of each embryo is tested to find out whether that potential child would have inherited the disorder or not. That seemed like an easy fix for a while because, you know, great, we wouldn't really have much agency. The doctors are the ones doing all this playing God and sorting through embryos, right, and choosing which ones are the best. And that felt kind of like a nice thing, a little bit of
a relief.
But on the other hand, that can be a very agonizing process, and it can be an unsuccessful process.
And not it in is terms a very of, expensive.
Yeah, and process. Very expensive. Not unsuccessful necessarily in terms of the genetic testing, but in terms of creating a successful pregnancy. So then ultimately another choice we had was to begin a pregnancy in the natural way. And we could use what's called chorionic villus sampling, or CVS, at about between 10 and 12 weeks of pregnancy to take a few cells from the surface of the placenta and find out whether the baby we had conceived would be born with a disorder or not. And depending on what kind of news we got back at about 13 weeks of pregnancy, potentially have to face an excruciating choice. So I feel like I might be leaving out one of our obvious options. Am I?
I don't think so. I think you covered them. When you were faced with these choices, the very first thing you did was start to really examine the disorder.
Yes.
To just make that big decision. Do we care? Do we
exactly.
care if a child of ours has this or not?
Right.
What did you decide to do to really understand it?
I had grown up with the disorder. My brother is a graceful and handsome and wonderful person who made it look easy. So maybe that's part of why for me, it was a bit of a shrug when my mom said they found the gene. I hadn't quite felt the maternal anguish of potentially passing on a problem to a child. But
even
also,
though you'd seen your mother struggle with it.
I had seen my mother struggle with her father's experience of the disorder, which was quite different from my brother's.
And you do write about times when your mother just apologized
yeah.
to your brother. Not when he could hear her, but was just grief-stricken
yes.
watching him struggle
yes.
and was so sorry that she felt she had inflicted this on him.
She did, and that was clear to me as a child. And also, we even knew that my grandfather's mother, my great-grandmother, felt the same way, felt guilty of something in the way she treated her son Earl, my grandfather. So I saw this pattern in the mothers, the carrier mothers who came before me. And maybe that was my hint that there is something that I needed to look more deeply at. So I kind of turned my attention away from my immediate family and went back to consider my grandfather's life. I felt a real pull to learn more about who he was, why his life was in so many ways tragic, which, of course, had affected my mother terribly as a child. So we knew there was a story there because my mom had never hidden the fact that she had a real difficult childhood in the shadow of a very challenged, very challenging, very brilliant, very pained man.
Well, tell me about Earl Hickman.
Earl Hickman was born in far western Nebraska in 1930, and he was the last of eight children and the only one of those children who was, well, the only boy who was fully affected with the disorder. In that family, he actually had a sister who had so many symptoms of the disorder that she would be considered also affected, unfortunately. But he grew up with sort of an identity as a small-town oddity. Those are his own words that I found in some of his psychiatric records. He was seen as a small-town oddity. Others who I spoke with from that area of Nebraska, that's the kind of Kimball County, Nebraska, said that he was seen as weak, and puny was a word I heard. So he always had this identity of kind of not being able to do enough. Even though he was tall and a great basketball player, he would just wither in the heat out there and couldn't work like his brothers on the farm. So he went away. He became a medical man, worked in Greeley, Colorado, and eventually became one of those personalities who was so constantly trying to prove himself that he was not an oddity, that he was not weak, he was not puny, that he could do everything anyone else could do and more, that he eventually just took on too much. He shouldered too much debt. He got involved with too many projects and with too many shady partners. He, without sleeping well at night, was self-medicating with samples. He was, for a while, a detail man, a drug rep, really. So he would avail himself of his own samples to try to keep himself alert and working and kind of be the best, try to be the best businessman, the best investor, become the richest, fastest, but also at the same time, you know, the best dad and the best husband. And he couldn't do any of it well in the end. And ultimately, his addictions took his life.
How did you gather all of this information about your grandfather?
My husband was such a trooper. I just had this kind of this obsession with his life. And once I felt like I had researched as much as I could from here in Iowa City, where I was working on the book, I finally realized we needed to hit the road. And Dan is always up for an adventure. So he packed the trunk and off we went. We drove to Nebraska. We drove through Wyoming and Colorado. I flew back to Seattle a few times. And throughout, actually, we did that trip twice, the Midwest trip. I interviewed his sister and his friends. I interviewed my grandmother, my mother, my father, many other relatives, many other acquaintances. The family members of a dear friend of my grandfather's who was shot in the warehouse where they worked together in 1962, which to me was really a crux moment in my grandfather's story, something that I really wanted to learn more about. So I met a lot of people trying to figure out what happened with Junior, why he died, what my grandfather had to do with it. I looked at medical records, legal records. I also just went and tried to feel the places and what it might have been like to have been my grandfather in those places and tried to find my way inside of his experience. I wanted to find empathy. I wanted to see the bright side because I didn't want to rule out the possibility of having a child with a disorder based on the fact that my grandfather was difficult. I wanted to see him as a full person and make sure that I was really considering how the disorder really did shape him, how it may not have shaped him, and ultimately what that might mean for me and my choices as I looked toward motherhood. So it was a big research journey, really was.
My guest is Bonnie Ruff. She has written about her research journey and her journey to parenthood in the book Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. If you've struggled with this kind of decision yourself, give us a call. We'd love to hear your story at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So you had to decide for yourself whether the disorder that your grandfather lived with was in some way responsible for the many problems that he had, for making him a miserable man.
That's exactly right. And that was very troubling for me to maybe even be asking that question in the first place, because I didn't want to assume that any future son of mine would be a new version of my grandfather or a new version of my brother or a new version of anyone else in the world. I know well enough that every new person is a new person. Yet I also felt like there were messages in my family tree that I would be a fool to ignore. So I had to go sort those out. And my grandfather's story really did balance for me what I had grown up with is when the disorder was quite normal, quite a normal thing.
Your mother also was very involved in your process of trying to find out the truth about your grandfather. What did it mean to her to look into her father's past?
I still remember the night. It was a very cold January night in Iowa City when I was really ready to start a writing project. And the absolute best true story I knew was my mother's, which in so many ways is really this also her father's story, the story of both of their lives as they fed into my own. And so I called her and I told her I wanted to write about her childhood and her father, but I couldn't do it without her help. At that time, I was in my mid-20s, which is, I think, a time in life when a lot of women, and maybe men too, are looking back at their mothers and thinking, maybe it's a good time to revise the way I understand this person. Maybe I can start to see her as a full person and not just mother. And you know, maybe that would be a good development for our relationship. And so that was part of it for me, was it was an opportunity to acknowledge my mom as a person and her experiences. And over the next couple of years, we had so many telephone interviews and in-person interviews. I know that sounds like a fancy word when you're just having conversations with your mom, but they were much different conversations than in the past when she had tried to tell me the stories, but I wasn't ready to listen. So ultimately, I think the book has been a nice thing for my mother. It was, you know, I thought maybe we would reach a new kind of understanding in our relationship, and I think the best thing, I think that even though this isn't explicit in the book, in many ways that's come true because my mom likes my book. And so it's kind of a new experience to say, well, here's the way I see things. And for her to say, that's beautiful. You know, it's usually, well, maybe you should think about it this way, or mom, come on, you're not really paying attention, or whatever. So this was a very big, intimate, risky thing for me to hand her and for her to accept and love. So it's been wonderful.
You spent a lot of time researching your grandfather who lived with the disorder, who had died when you were born, about a year old, so long mm-hmm. before you could remember. Mm-hmm. But of course, in your life, you had your brother who yes. was also living with this disorder. So you had someone you loved very much mm-hmm. and had been close to, although he was in college and you were a graduate student living 1,000 miles apart. Mm-hmm. so you had drifted apart a little bit. But How did you approach this with your brother? Because you actually had to ask him for a blood sample when you were starting this process. What did you talk to him about?
I called him also from that little bungalow in Iowa. I made a lot of tough phone calls from that house now that I think about it. I was really nervous. Dan and I were just starting the process of we had decided to find out for sure whether I carried the disorder. And what the doctor said was that, you know, even though we pretty much know what your disorder is, there are basically different precise mutations for it. And we want to know exactly which one to look for in your DNA. And the best way to find that out is to figure out exactly which one your brother has. So I needed to ask my brother for a blood sample. And I couldn't do that without explaining why. So I did. I called him at college, and he was so happy to hear from me, which immediately made me feel guilty because I realized, oh, gosh, I'm only calling him because I want something. But, you know, I guess that happens. It was a very nerve-wracking conversation for me.
I'm going to cut you off there because we're going to go to a break, and I don't want to have to interrupt you once you really get into what happened during that conversation and his response. My guest today is Bonnie Ruff. She's the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. The book is about her path to parenthood and the very difficult decisions, very complex decisions she had to make because of advances in medical technology. If you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to. 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you've gone through a similar struggle, we'd love to hear your story. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with Bonnie Ruff, who has written a book called Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. She'll be reading from that book tonight at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. She wrote much of the book also in Iowa City. And we'd love for you to join our conversation, if you like, at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bonnie, before the break, I was just asking you, you called your brother who has this genetic disorder, HED, and you had to ask him for a blood sample and you had to tell him why. Mm-hmm. Tell me what his response was.
You know, I told him I had a really big favor to ask him. And also in that moment when I called, I realized that I had actually hoped to go through all of my family planning without my brother ever knowing that we had even considered trying to avoid the disorder. That's a big part of who he is. But I told him I had to ask him a favor. I wanted to know. I told him that we were going to try to find out if I was a carrier so we could think about maybe trying to avoid passing that disorder on. He was so surprised to find out we could do such a thing. And I said, well, we would just need you to give a sample of your blood so that they could compare it to mine. And he kind of paused. That's all? You know, like, what are you so worried about? And I said, well, Luke, you know, I don't want you to feel like Dan and I think there's something wrong with you. We'd be so proud to have a son like you. And he just kind of, I could sort of hear him just blow out a little air and say, I wouldn't want your kids to have this. That was the beginning of what has been a consistently gracious and wise response on my brother's part to our story.
It seems like having that moment with your brother would have made your decision so much easier. Did it make it clear at that point, or did you still have to struggle?
I still had to struggle. I don't know why. Maybe if only it could have made it clear at that point. But it's still, I think what it helped to make clear is that we wished to avoid passing the disorder on, but then we still had to face a whole battery of decisions about how. There are options. There are effective ways to not pass the disorder to a child, but none of them are easy or perfect choices. They all have problems.
Sue is on the line from Mason City. Hello, Sue.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have a child who has a disorder, and I'm just discovering that I believe it is genetic, just by my own, observing my family, finding out through my husband, oh, my dad couldn't read either. And I'm going, wow, this must be genetic. Mm. It isn't dyslexia. It's a disorder. It's adjustment disorder. This is what they keep telling me. I want to know what doctors, where do I start to start procedure you're on?
Oh, that's a good question. It may be different depending on, you know, where you live, but I think that the first thing to do is speak with your primary care physician and let them know that you have genetic concerns, and then they may refer you to a geneticist. Usually once you're in the system with a geneticist, you'll also be assigned a genetic counselor, which is someone who is trained in the differences in disorders and exactly what a family's choices might be with family planning and whether there is a test available or different options for whether or not to pass it on. So I would say to begin with your doctor.
Okay, so how did you get your child or your brother make it through education? What, I'm not really sure. I just turned the program out. I don't know what his diagnosis is, his disorder, but how did you make it through the system where they accepted the disorder?
Do you mean, are you asking, it sounds like you're asking whether he had a hard time in school because
yeah.
he was a little different. And
yeah.
that was such a huge part for me about looking ahead at my own potential children's lives, was thinking about the very painful things I saw my brother experience. I'll never forget seeing him at the bus stop, just this little cute button of a guy, being called Cancer Boy because he just didn't look right to the other kids. I remember being in sixth grade and another boy in my class, my mom brought my cute baby brother to school and he had, you know, dark circles under his eyes. And as I mentioned, that saddle nose deformity, he was a cute baby as far as, you know, most people are concerned. But apparently one boy in my class thought it would be a good idea to tell me, you know, your brother looks dead.
Oh, wow.
And those kinds of things, those were the painful things that I was, that to me reinforced what my brother said when he said, I wouldn't want your kids to have this. I know he hid so much more from us, too.
Right. Well, and Sue, in answer to your question academically, though, with HED, this is the disorder that we're talking about, which, again, is, I'll find it on my list here. It's hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia,
it's
HED.
It's physical, yeah. There
and
aren't any learning
mental.
Or mental disabilities associated with that.
Okay. Well, Sue, good luck with your journey. That sounds like a very difficult
yeah, best
journey,
wishes.
And I hope you and your son have a good journey. Will from Ames also has a question for you. Hello, Will.
Hello.
Hi, Will, I need you to turn your radio down.
I got it off.
Okay, thanks.
My question is about adoption. I was mm-hmm. curious, considering all the pitfalls and negatives that have been brought up in this conversation about genetic anomalies, why not adopt someone else's child who presumably would not have one? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Will.
Thanks. That's a great question and one that I've certainly been asked and certainly one that Dan and I asked ourselves. I remember when we were first starting to talk about the disorder, I asked Dan, would you rather have a child, would you rather adopt a child or have a child of our own with HED? And he said, I'd still want a child of our own. I felt the same way at the time, although I'm not sure we would say the same thing now that we've learned so much about what a wonderful thing it is to be a healthy person. It's a great blessing. We did think about adoption, but I think for us, there's a part of it that can't be explained. I still can't quite articulate what it is. Maybe it's just kind of a inability to deny a very deep human desire to procreate, to see what your own biological children, see who they might be, because we are able to conceive children. I don't think we would ever hesitate to adopt We would never choose to be childless over choosing to adopt. But we had a really good shot at having our own children and having them be healthy. And I also, but I've heard so many heartwarming stories from people who have just amazing adoption tales from their families to share. But I also wouldn't want to be naive about it. I know that, you know, you mentioned pitfalls, and I think that there can be also pitfalls with adoption, just like with any other one of our options. All along, we felt that we really didn't have a perfect answer, so it was a matter of choosing the one that was the best for us at that time.
At the same time, as you were going through all of this, you also had to deal with what those of us who don't have a genetic disorder in our past have to deal with, which is this the right time to become parents? Mm-hmm. And often, this is a stereotype, but often we are ready before our husbands and we have to do some waiting. So did the fact that you had gone through this journey and made your choices and felt ready, did that make it more difficult when your husband said, now?
You are so perceptive. Yeah, I think we went on a long journey. It took us about 3 years to figure out exactly what our priorities were and exactly what our plan would be to try to have a healthy child. We had our plan essentially mapped out for what steps we would take in what circumstances. So then the last thing left was for me to get up the courage to start. And I felt that courage one August. And I was afraid that if we didn't try for a pregnancy soon, I would lose that courage and I might not find it again, because, again, that path was going to be difficult no matter what. So we ran into that. But wait a minute, you know, what about traveling the world? Well, we have been traveling the world. But I think, yeah, you're right. That's an old narrative.
So I want you to tell me about the plan that you did make. What was your plan? You even wrote it down so that you would be able to stick with it and agree on it. What was that plan?
Our plan ultimately was that we did want to have a child who was free of HED. And so what we decided to do, the best fit we thought for us as poor, you know, just out of grad school students who were fairly ready to start a family, was to attempt a pregnancy in the usual way and experience the first 3 months or first trimester of pregnancy as a tentative pregnancy. We would do the chorionic villus sampling. For us, that was going to take place at about 11 weeks, and then wait up to about 3 weeks for those results. And we finally decided that if we found out that our baby was a male affected with the disorder, we would end the pregnancy. And that was the dread that I lived with for the beginning of my first pregnancy. It was agonizing. There are so many women and families who deal with tentative pregnancies, even people who are just waiting to see if a pregnancy will hold or if an amnio will come back clear. That tentative time when you don't really want to tell anybody, when you want to celebrate, but at the same time you don't know for sure, looking ahead 8-9 months, whether you're going to be a mother or not. It's very painful. It was something that I wished I could be talking about, but unfortunately, the possibility of ending a pregnancy is such a taboo subject, at least in the U.S. I live in Holland now, and I've learned that that's not a taboo subject everywhere. So I think a tentative pregnancy in Amsterdam might be something that I could chat with the other moms at the park about in a more casual, warm-hearted way than I was able to here in the U.S. But I felt very alone. And I've since learned that I wasn't nearly alone, but I did feel that way.
In your planning process, you published an essay in the New York Times, so you had laid out your choices in a very public way. What kind of reaction did you get from people to not even your decision, but the options that you presented?
Yeah. At that time, Dan and I really weren't even close to ready to have a baby, but we knew the dilemma we would face. And it was very eye-opening to get those dozens and dozens of letters that came back. I essentially did just lay out those different options, have children, not have children, let fate decide, adoption, IVF with testing or a tentative pregnancy. And the letters I got back were amazing because they were, for the most part, each one was someone telling me, here's what you should do. You should adopt. Or here's what you should do. You should do the IVF. For the price of a car, you could have a healthy child. That's a no-brainer. Or here's what you should do. Anything you want, as long as you take abortion off the table. Here's what you should do. Don't even think about diluting our gene pool by even considering, you know, choosing which genetic child to have. And then there were certainly a lot of letters from people who were just appreciative of someone telling that story. But what was so interesting to me was to see how sure people were about, really, I think what they were saying is, here's what I would do. And that's what really confirmed for me how personal each of these choices must be, and that they really do belong within families. I can't say necessarily that in the future Dan and I would feel the same way. Maybe a tentative pregnancy might feel too painful for us in 5 years, and we would hopefully we'll be millionaires at that time as well, and then IVF will be so affordable. But I'm not sure. I don't know what we would choose again. I think we would probably follow the same path because I have felt very good about the way it's worked out for us so far.
What was the outcome of that first test with your first pregnancy?
We found out that we were having a daughter, and a daughter means healthy. So we were thrilled. Yeah, I have a 3-year-old little girl at home with her dad in Amsterdam at the moment.
That was not your only pregnancy, though.
No.
You also conceived a child a couple of years later.
That's
right. And what was the result that time?
Unfortunately, we did end up facing that crisis moment that we had prepared ourselves for so many years. So I didn't have a second baby. And I'll never forget the moment that my genetic counselor called with that news. I was devastated. I was crying in my husband's arms, literally while I was holding the phone to my ear. But I felt this swelling in my chest of gratitude. It was unmistakably gratitude. In the midst of all that sadness, I was so thankful that I could know and that I still had the choice to make, that I was part of this new generation, and that I had had the time to really look over my options.
What do you want people to take away from your story when they read this book?
There are a few things. I think that all of us, when we look toward parenthood, or whatever the next stage in growing up is going to be for us, there's something all of us, I think, have challenging choices to make and can draw from the past to think about the future. Even when it's uncomfortable, it was very valuable for me to take the time to stare down the scariest parts of what I might face and think it all through. I also hope that the story is clearly my own story. I am pretty sure there isn't a single sentence in here that tells anyone else what I think they ought to do. But I hope that it's honest enough so that anyone going through these things might not feel alone.
Bonnie Ruff is the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. She will be reading from her book tonight at 7 o'clock at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available on our website, iowapublicradio.org. You can send any questions or comments to us by email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.